Welcome, everybody. This is Liver Lineup, Updates and Unfiltered Insights with Kim Brown and Nancy Rowe. I'm Nancy, and I'll let Kim introduce herself. And then we have a really amazing guest, Tatiana Kushner, here, who's going to talk to us a little bit about hepatitis D. D is in Delta. Kim, why don't you say hello?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for joining us, Tatiana. Kim Brown. I'm at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, Transplant Hepatology. Nancy, where are you?
I am currently in my study. I work at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, Illinois. And so I think, Tatiana, why don't you tell us a little bit about Delta? And Kim, I think that we might have a little bit of an up on you for this, in that Chicago is a bit of a hot spot for Delta. But I know that Tatiana has also got a lot of Delta patients. So some people really go through almost a lifetime of taking care of hepatology patients and see maybe one patient with Delta. And I know that, I have, not hundreds, but I have taken care of multiple Delta patients and currently have probably five or six under my immediate management. And so, Tatiana, I'll hand it over to you. Tell us where you are and why this is an important topic for you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'd rather be, there's no other place I'd rather be this morning than here. So I am a hepatologist and I practice at Weill Cornell in New York. And as you mentioned about Chicago, I think New York has also been called a hotspot for Delta hepatitis, which, probably should be taken with a grain of salt. It doesn't mean, as you said, that we're seeing, hundreds of Delta hepatitis patients in our practice, but we do see a fair amount. And I think that's largely driven by the fact that we see many patients from different immigrant communities. And from our understanding of Delta hepatitis, similarly to hepatitis B, actually, most of the people in the U.S. that we're seeing with Delta hepatitis are from more endemic regions, and they're immigrants from those areas that come to the U.S. and then we see them here. And, I think Delta hepatitis is very interesting, and we are continuing to learn more about it. I think maybe even 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, there really was not really much discussion about Delta hepatitis, even at national conferences, at ASLD, at EASL. And it was sort of, oh, this is something really rare. We don't really see it. We don't think too much about it. And there's not really a treatment. So not too much effort in terms of kind of advancing our understanding and improving the care for these patients. But over the past, I would say, what would you say, like 5 years, we've really seen such an increase in interest in Delta hepatitis, both from understanding kind of the epidemiology, the aspect of kind of the very rapid disease progression and who is at risk for rapid disease progression to cirrhosis and HCC. And of course, probably most excitedly, the understanding that we need better treatments and actual recent approval of treatment for Delta hepatitis in the U.S.
Yeah, Tatiana, I would even say that we were a bit limited by diagnostics a while ago, so that I think that the big thing is the new treatment options and the upcoming treatment options. But, not that we have lots of Delta patients, but I remember earlier in my career, the challenges of just getting someone tested. And then the NIH, there are people who have been Delta advocates for a long time. I remember trying to send people to the NIH for probably it would have been lunafarnib at that time, studies, because they were interested in the patients and compensating them for their travels to come to the NIH. And I know, at least personally, our big explosion in the interest really lined up with that first lunafarnib study, where we were a trial site. I imagine that you were also. And that started to make us be a little bit more, hey, listen, we need to enroll patients into this trial. Let's look a little more closely at our hepatitis B patients to see if they're co-infected. Kim, do you have Delta?
So we have a tiny, 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 tiny group. I have one patient currently, but I think the other thing that restricted us, maybe because we didn't have good therapeutics, is the guidelines as to who we should be testing, right? I think the fact that now there's more of a inclination with, you know, with therapeutics now to just test everybody, right? To identify these individuals. I think that was probably a barrier that needed to come down.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also to Nancy's point, I almost forgot about the challenges with the testing. So, you know, years ago, we, in order to get, well, HCV antibody, we were able to obtain pretty well within our health system. But to get an HCV RNA, an actual HCV level, it wasn't available in our system. So we had to get an additional paper requisition and write down exactly the ID for the test and then fill it out for every patient. Half the times it was still sent incorrectly. And then, you know, it was really, it added extra steps to the process. And what we did have in our system was qualitative HDV RNA. So it tells you, are they positive or not, but not the amount. And so it wasn't really as helpful. And to your point also about the NIH, actually, the way that I initially got interested in Delta hepatitis was in the year 2015, when Theo Heller, who probably was one of the main leaders, right, in thinking about Delta hepatitis long before anyone else, he came to give a grand rounds at Penn, where I was a GI fellow. And the grand round wasn't even about Delta hepatitis, but, you know, we were having lunch during the grand round and Theo Heller said, have you looked at Delta hepatitis in the national VA system, to David Kaplan and I? And David Kaplan's like, oh, that's a good idea. And I was like, what's Delta hepatitis and why would we look in the VA system? David Kaplan's like, that's a good idea. We should look at that. And so we did. So we looked at all the patients in the national VA system who had a diagnosis of hepatitis B. And we looked to see how many of them ever had a test for Delta hepatitis. And then among those people who actually eventually were diagnosed with Delta, you know, what was their disease progression like? Was it really true that they had more advanced progression of disease and more in higher incidence of HCC and cirrhosis? And we did find it was true. But probably what was most important that we found is that very few people were ever tested for Delta. It was less than 10% of patients with hepatitis B that ever had a Delta test. And the VA is kind of a contained system. So, you know, the veterans aren't really leaving the system to get tested elsewhere. So it was kind of shocking that we're just not even identifying these patients. And yet clearly they're having more advanced disease.
I think that goes back to Kim's point, though, because that was a really important study, Tatiana, and I think you're first author on that. But it confirmed that the VA was following the guidelines, essentially, which at that time and our guidelines still advocate for Delta testing in patients who are virally suppressed but with increased liver enzymes or who have increased risk factors, which is pretty loosely defined. And I think that for at least AASLD, because there are Delta guidelines for the European Liver Society, but AASLD has a Delta Expo that's supposed to be coming, so that the update in the hepatitis B guidance did not include Delta testing. But we do have a paper that's been commissioned or that's in process that's supposed to address hepatitis D. And I believe, I'm not going to say that I know, but I believe it will advocate for Delta testing in all Hep B surface antigen positive individuals at least once.
Well, and I think that's important. You know, we've had many discussions about the utility of ALT in driving decision making, right? And so, you know, people who were virally suppressed and had an ALT of 53, which was normal in somebody's, you know, laboratory, that wouldn't necessarily fall into the guidelines of testing, or somebody who was metabolic. And so I think having those guidelines that require physicians to think through a litany of things that, you know, will prompt them to do something is probably not a great strategy. Right. So I do like the universal testing idea. I think we'll find more patients, and now that we have better treatments, be able to, you know, impact their health.
I agree. And in particular, you know, in the existing AASLD guidelines, there's a whole list of countries, like endemic regions, that you know should prompt you to test. And I think very few providers are thinking about, you know, kind of these Delta hepatitis hotspots around the world, that if their patient is from there, other than maybe Mongolia is one that many people are aware of. It's hard to remember. So I'm very excited that AASLD will come on board, hopefully, with recommending universal testing.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about a care cascade? So, I think, Tatiana, one of the important things we've suggested that you should get Delta testing in all Hep B surface antigen positive individuals. But, you know, I think that the care cascade for Delta is pretty simple. It doesn't reflex, unfortunately. Although I do think that, is it Quest or LabCorp that really does have a reflex cascade? But why don't you at least help our listeners know what they should do when they test for Delta and where we start going as we, you know, talk about the exciting new developments and therapeutics.
Yeah, so I think yes, the idea of reflex testing is commonly discussed, although and I think you know the Europeans did lead the way in terms of implementing reflex testing, and reflex testing could mean a few different things in the Delta hepatitis context. One is the reflex test from hepatitis B surface antigen to Delta antibody, which automatically means that everyone with hepatitis B is screened for Delta. And then, you know, this idea of double reflex testing is the idea that, you know, it will be an automated testing cascade where people will be tested from hepatitis B surface antigen to HDV antibody and then subsequently to HDV RNA. So you complete the full testing cascade. And there are some discussions and some publications and some thoughts about whether that should be the case. But at the moment in the US, I think most health systems do not have this reflex testing implemented. And the cascade really, again, should be starting with anyone who has hepatitis B surface antigen positivity, so chronic hepatitis B. I think sometimes the question comes up of, well, what if they're just core positive, hepatitis B core positive, but don't have surface antigen? In that context, you know, I don't recommend a routine Delta screening, but if they're hepatitis B surface antigen positive, then you order the Delta antibody test. And then if that comes back positive, then you order the HDV RNA, and then you determine to see if they're actively viremic. There are some patients that we test that just their HDV antibody comes back positive and their HDV RNA is negative. Or actually, just yesterday, a colleague texted me. She had a patient who was HDV antibody positive, but then the HDV RNA result came back as detected less than 40. So Nancy, I'm not sure actually, or Kim, like how would you would she asked me, well, okay, what do I do with this? And my question was, you know, even with Hep C, we saw some labs kind of report these results differently. But when I see the word detected, I assume it's there. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, well, we can come back to even what you do with someone who is Delta antibody positive and PCR negative, because I think that I've had some discussion with some of my colleagues on that. But for that person, I would probably repeat the PCR. You know, when we talk about diagnostics, there has been a lot of discussion on the accuracy and how things are processed when you're looking at a HDRNA. And I imagine a little bit like a person who is detected but not quantifiable for hepatitis B. It's a confirmation that the virus is there. It's just not replicating, you know, at a significant level. And so I would think the same would be true for D, except as an RNA virus, you imagine that it should be either detectable and present or not detectable. But what did you tell her to do, Tatiana?
Well, I told her I hedged. I told her I told her that I wouldn't initiate treatment now, but I would repeat in 3 months and see where it was. And I guess to your point of those people that are undetected, you know, there is also that discussion. Well, sometimes the virus does appear, and you know, sometimes there's even mean, I've heard a Delta cure that there could be spontaneous clearance too, more than we previously may have thought is possible. So in that patient, I did say just repeat in 3 months and see.
But, that's logical.
Yeah.
For at your institutions, is the RNA a send out?
So
or do you do it in house?
It is a send out to Quest or LabCorp, but the way our EPIC is set up, which was different than my prior institution, it's all within EPIC. So sort of because it's not available in-house, when I order the test, it automatically goes to Quest. So I don't have to think, you know, oh, I need to send this test to Quest.
But yeah.
I click it. So yeah. that does make it easier. And so I could have a patient who some of the labs are run in-house and that one is sent to Quest and then, you know, doesn't add any additional thought process for me. And it takes about a week to result in my experience.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the barriers in our institution, maybe others, in terms of reflex testing. If one test is done in-house and another is done out, that we ran into that with reflex testing for C, for example. But our testing cascade is very similar. We've actually gone, again, I think probably many of us, it's prompted us to go back into our own patient population and just test everybody who has never been tested, you know, for Delta. Most of us, I think, test everyone, but I don't think historically that has been the case.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, actually at Mount Sinai, we did implement reflex testing and we had exactly that issue initially that the Delta, so the reflex testing that was implemented was from hepatitis B surface antigen to Delta antibody. And we had to develop an in-house Delta antibody assay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that was like a long process that the lab collaborated with us on and they got it approved by the New York State and it was really excellent. But, you know, in the process of developing this, we actually had a few barriers that came up that were a little bit unexpected. And it was, you know, a few years ago before we had an approved treatment, for example, and before AASLD was about to update their recommendations. But, you know, questions such as, well, you know, we really can't do, you know, from ethics and compliance, the idea that we can't really do reflex testing without patient and providers being aware of what Delta hepatitis is or without them being aware that they will have a reflex test. And so, you know, at one point they said, well, you need to consent patients if you're going to do the reflex test, which literally defeats the purpose of a reflex test.
Right.
They said, we will not be consenting these patients. And then they said, well, we don't know if it's cost effective. So for the first year of the test that it was implemented, it was actually covered by a grant. You know, so we paid for every Delta test that was done. And then, you know, the decision was, well, you know, you can't just have a reflex test. You also want to give the providers the opportunity to just order the surface antigen test alone. And so, you know, the provider will have to choose the reflex test in order to order the reflex test. And so I think that, you know, again, the field is advancing. So I think maybe more people, health systems will come on board, but it was really interesting to see kind of these questions come up, which, you know, when Europeans discovered their experience, it was a non-issue. They would, in Spain, they implemented it on the lab side. So no provider or patient was aware, it seems like, based on their description, it was just done on the lab. Mm-hmm. And if a Delta test came out positive, then, you know, they reported back. So I think we'll see how the situation evolves, but it will be interesting to see if, you know, with new guidance, treatments, that there will be more of a acceptance of, you know, reflex testing, or, you know, we will stick with our traditional cascade, which requires multiple steps.
Yeah, I mean, we think of Hep C reflex testing now as pretty standard of care, but thinking back as to the effort it took to get that in place, it was really challenging. I mean, even just from the fact that you're going from a, you know, a screening study to a diagnostic study that led, you know, the coders to like have a meltdown because you can't reflex test because the code would be different. And now it's so important to identify in individuals with hepatitis C that you hope the hepatitis B and D kind of follow that road. But it doesn't surprise me that you ran into barriers that you didn't imagine would exist, because I think similar things happen with the hep C reflex cascade.
Maybe it's just a matter of time and kind of more, yeah, time and more guidance and more interest in the field for people to eventually get on board.
So I'd be interested to know from both of you, actually, historically, since you do have relatively large populations of Delta patients, how have you approached treatment in the past? And what has been your experience with that in terms of uptake of treatment and response to treatment?
Yeah, so being older than Tatiana, the vast majority of my patients originally were offered pegylated interferon or not treated at all. You know, I think that we didn't have as many useful tools, non-invasive tools for staging. And so, you know, we didn't follow these individuals and probably didn't understand their risk to the same degree that we do now. And then when we, you know, we've been very fortunate as a hotspot to have a lot of clinical trial opportunities. So most of the real focus on treatment came when we started to have the lonafarnib studies. Then we had Lambda, and now we have Vir and Blue Jay, and almost all of our patients have been treated through those clinical trials, which means that there's a subset of individuals who have had no opportunity for treatment. Right. You know, decompensated cirrhotics really get triaged towards transplant or HCC. And so and maybe we can also talk to Tatiana about how you manage a pre-transplant or a transplant patient, because I think that that is also changing. But our sickest patients went to transplant, and the rest of them either are being closely observed because they were too healthy for clinical trials, often because their ALT was normal, or they were co-infected with HIV, or they had something that excluded them from a clinical trial, and they're just now kind of in line to see if they can get access to bulevirtide, which I hope that Tatiana talks to us about.
And before we dive into that, I'm curious, so what was your approach with pegylated interferon? Because, you know, the EASL guidance says that every Delta hepatitis patient should be offered pegylated interferon. And the ASLD guidance also sort of says that, that, you know, you really should offer it to every patient. So did you offer it to every patient? Did you encourage it? Or was it like, we have this treatment, but it's tough, and I don't know that I would do it, because that's sort of how I sold it. And maybe that was a mistake, but.
Right. I mean, like I said earlier in the conversation, I think it was, is it Chris Koh? I think that Theo and Heller and Dr. Koh had a, you know, trial opportunities at the NIH. And I really tried to get my patients to go to the NIH. And I think we really underdiagnosed also. I mean, that handful of early patients that would sometimes go to the NIH or not, were probably pretty sick, or there was something that triggered Delta testing, where now we find patients at different stages in their co-infection. But I did talk about pegylated interferon with all of my patients, and some of them were agreeable. Many of them, probably I didn't emphasize how aggressive the disease was going to be, and probably didn't understand that they should have tried it.
Right. And I guess before that conversation, the question of, you know, fibrosis assessment also is the cascade step that we didn't spend as much time on. But, you know, that's another really key feature. And, you know, there had been discussions at a point of like, well, should we be doing biopsies in these patients because we don't know as much? But I think at the very least, you know, FibroScan is pretty good. I think the specific cutoffs of what cirrhosis is versus not You know, there's some debate about that, but for sure, fibrosis assessment is a really key part of once they have that diagnosis to determine how advanced their disease is. And that may also influence your decision about, well, in the absence of other treatment options, which is no longer the case, do I really need to push pegylated interferon? Because, you know, if they're F2, F3 fibrosis, then I would be more likely probably to really encourage that than, you know, if they have no fibrosis.
So as we start to talk about bulevirtide, I'm going to ask you this question because the individual that I'm currently treating is on pegylated interferon, and so that's going to be a question whether whether I'm going to add on how I'm going to look to you guys to tell me how to manage that. But we don't have access to clinical trials. We don't have enough delta. We've never had Delta trials, in Michigan, and so I think that what we've always had has just been, pegylated interferon. And again, based on EASL guidelines, should be offered. This individual, actually, her daughter came saying, "I want treatment for my mother." So
Right. And how's she tolerating it?
very well. She's this,
Wow.
very stoic woman from Pakistan. So she's.
That is
It's just
amazing.
like, yep, everything's good. But I will tell you, me getting pegylated interferon for her was a challenge. Like the pharmacist, I mean, it used to be like everybody we treated was on interferon, right? It was like this very easy thing to do with hepatitis C. It took me forever to get a pharmacist to figure out how to actually do this. Okay. So.
Oh, yeah,
Not
interesting.
as
How's she
routinely used
responding?
anymore.
Yeah.
She's her viral load is falling, so she's
Okay.
having a response. But again, I'm going to ask you about bulevirtide and whether I should try to add that on. But anyway.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, we're all just at EASL, the European conference recently, and there's a dedicated Delta Hepatitis meeting that Hepatitis Delta International Network. And there was, of course, a lot of discussion about bulevirtide. And, you know, the approval in the US was the week prior to EASL. And someone asked, well, in the US, will you be using bulevirtide in combination with pegylated interferon? And they turned to me because I guess I was like, you know, a person from the US sitting in the audience. And I said, no, I don't intend to because my patients don't tolerate it well. And, you know, I would probably just do long-term monotherapy. And the, actually, it was Pietro Lampertico. He, a Delta hepatitis leader, you know, really went on kind of a, gave a long talk about how, you know, the combination with pegylated interferon and bulevirtide significantly increases the likelihood of response after finite treatments.
Right.
And so that would mean really at least a year of pegylated interferon with the bulevirtide, followed by a year of bulevirtide, and then you can have significantly higher response rates off treatment than if you just did monotherapy. So I think in the context of your patient, especially if she's tolerating it well, I think I would consider just adding the bulevirtide,
Yeah.
seeing if she can go for a year, and then taking her off the pegylated interferon, and then continuing on the bulevirtide monotherapy. And again, because she's already showed that she can tolerate it, but I feel like I would be hesitant to initiate the two in someone who is not already on pegylated interferon.
No, it is interesting because, looking at that data with combination therapy, the overall sustained response is much better. I do wonder, in the United States, where we are so driven by insurance companies, whether they will be looking for a finite therapy as opposed to long-term monotherapy. But we'll see. I don't know that they've actually allowed any prescriptions yet, so.
Right.
No, my patients are still waiting on bulevirtide. And
Yeah.
I think just like you already discussed, the early access in Europe, the clinical, I mean, the early access study for bulevirtide kind of answer some of that question, Kim, because it was up to the investigator. And some of those patients really started on interferon, pegylated interferon, and then had bulevirtide added. Yes. Some of them started on bulevirtide and had peg added, and some of them kind of intermittently bounced back and forth. We used a lot of peg in the lonafarnib trial. So we've been using peg in this population with direct acting antivirals. And I wouldn't say that lonafarnib was greatly tolerated. It does have some side effects, but we didn't find that peg was the same challenge that it might have been in our hep C studies. Yeah. And so a little bit like the European guidance, if you have a patient who's got less advanced disease and you think that a curative option might be an opportunity for them, I would use dual therapy and talk about finite therapy. There's no resistance to bulevirtide. So I think that if your patient relapsed with that strategy, you could restart them on bulevirtide or think about one of the future treatments. But the EASL guidance, and we'll see what ASLD comes up with, but they would say that if your patient's got more advanced disease, then maintenance therapy is in the best interest of that individual. And then I would probably just start bulevirtide and not peg. I mean, we learned with some of the early Delta trials, the lesson that we learned a long time ago with hep C is that patients who have cirrhosis sometimes decompensate on pegylated interferon. And just the reminder that those cirrhotic patients had to be looked at a little bit carefully when you were trying to use combination treatment. And I don't know what Tatiana was doing, but we probably pushed some of our patients that were had more advanced cirrhosis towards these clinical trials just because we knew we needed an option for them. And they, you know, in a real life scenario, we would have known that PEG was probably not going to be a great opportunity for them. And I think that part of that is why the Lambda study, you know, ended early, is that we were putting patients that probably shouldn't have been getting, or Lambda would have been a little more controversial, into these studies, and then they decompensated.
Right. And then just one additional point about the bulevirtide, which is why I think it especially came up at that HDIN meeting at EASL, was that in the US, we have approved the 10 milligram dose, or it's marketed as 8.5 milligrams, whereas in Europe, they have the 2 milligram dose approved, which I don't recall ever seeing this in any other medication or context where we have different, literally different doses approved in different continents. But I think that the Europeans feel a little jealous in that sense, because the off-treatment response in the 10 milligram in the MIR-204 study was also significantly better than in the 2 milligram combination arm. And so they view this really as an opportunity, because I think it was, you know, over 40% that had, you know, off treatment response on the 10 milligram compared to, I think, around 30% in the 2 milligram. So I think in particular, there's this question of, well, if we have access to this higher dose, maybe we really should be strongly considering the pegylated interferon. But I would say, you know, in my practice specifically, I just don't have so much comfort also and experience with pegylated interferon. I did have one patient that asked me, also similar to your patient, she said, well, I've tried this in Uzbekistan many years ago, but I want to give it a try again. And so, you know, I did get it for her and she tried it. She lasted 3 weeks and she felt horrible. She was really tired. Her platelet count went down. She was feeling very unwell. And she, similarly as her telling me, I need to start it, she's like, I need to stop it. So I think it depends on the patient as well.
Well, I think this is one, you know, this is probably the only thing that is good about being older than you, which is I have a lot of experience with interferon.
Well, that's amazing.
And, you know, many, many, many people were treated and tolerated the medication. We got them through. It was a lot more work, but they did it.
Yes. Well, that experience, I think, will be really, really helpful here, because I think people like me who have limited experience are, you know, a little bit hesitant. And I think I should get over that and get past that.
The other thing you might want to think about, Tatiana, is that we still have like at least one nurse practitioner that has extensive treatment experience from Hep C. And the things that, I mean, and Kim, it's just like, it's a bad flashback, but, you know, remembering the neuropsychiatric side effects, the, you know, ophthalmologic side effects. I mean, those of us that treated a lot of patients with Hep C, you know, these complications were just no-brainers. You saw them all. And so you were like, when someone complained of something, you're like, oh, yep, I know what that is. And I think that when you have not got that experience, these things are pretty scary. But just find an old person to pair with and we'll get through it.
Yeah, no, the best thing is you don't have to pair it with ribavirin, because the combination of the two of those.
Or that puts telaprevir, bisepivir.
Oh, yeah, that's going to help.
Well, I know that we're not going to go all the way down memory lane. So let's look futuristically. Tatiana, why don't you tell us a little bit?
Wow. Okay, let's look to the future now. That was too traumatic.
too traumatic. We're looking forward. Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about bulevirtide, but more importantly, you know, some of the therapeutics that are going to be following bulevirtide.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, as we mentioned, bulevirtide is now officially approved as of last month in the U.S. So it's really approved for patients with delta hepatitis. There's no minimal fibrosis stage or, you know, any kind of really specific limitations on who with delta hepatitis can get it. So that's excellent. And, you know, bulevirtide is a daily injection. So people should keep that in mind. And it will take a certain type of patient who is able to do that. And not only is it a daily injection, but it does require some steps in terms of preparation on the patient side. So they actually have to reconstitute it themselves, meaning they get a nice little package with the powder and the sterile water, and they need to reconstitute it themselves, draw it up themselves, switch needles, inject it. So it takes a few steps. I think one benefit that I've learned about the U.S. formulation is that it actually does not need to be refrigerated. And that was an intentional update by Gilead. So in Europe, with their 2 milligram dose, they need to refrigerate it. But we in the U.S. have the higher dose that does not need to be refrigerated. So hopefully that will make it more straightforward for patients. But I think in making that decision with patients, they have to be aware that this is a little bit of an undertaking. But again, I think Gilead has done a really good job in terms of preparing and having wraparound services, including, you know, someone that a patient can call, a nurse, nursing line in case they have issues, training for them in order to be able to do the injection. So I think that probably, I think most people can get on board, but, you know, there will be some that it may be a little bit of a limitation. Aside from bulevirtide, I think it's really exciting that now we actually have other phase 3 studies for treatment of delta hepatitis. And I think the two that you already mentioned, Nancy, one is the VIR study, which is tobevibart elipsiran. And the other one is Blue Jay, but now Mirum with the drug brelovitug. And so, you know, we have those clinical trials, and actually at our site, both have already closed screening. I'm not sure if, you know, they're closed everywhere, but it's, you know, two very exciting potential treatment options. The VIR-1, which is tobevibart elipsiran, is two agents that work in different ways. One is a monoclonal antibody. One is an siRNA. And it is an injection as well. And it is given once monthly. For the clinical trial, it's done in the clinic. But, you know, perhaps in the future, it could be done at home. I'm not sure. And then the other one, the Mirum drug, brelovitug, in the clinical trial, there were two options. One was a weekly injection at home of a lower dose, which is 3 milligrams, compared to a higher dose, 900 milligram, given once monthly in the clinic. And both of these treatments have been, the phase 2 study results have been published for both and have shown very promising results. And then at EASL, we saw 96-week data from the VIR study, where showed outcomes after 96 weeks of treatment. And then for the Mirum study, we saw the phase 2B data presented at EASL, which is kind of a smaller version of the phase 3 program. And, you know, in a nutshell, not comparing them head to head, but it's very clear that both of them are working very well in terms of not just getting virologic response, which is, you know, pre-specified by the FDA as at least a 2-log decline, but actually reaching target not detected, undetectable HDV RNA. And again, not to compare them head to head and, you know, to let everyone know, there are planned head-to-head trials with bulevirtide with both of these programs. But what we're seeing in terms of virologic response and target not detected is definitely higher than what we were seeing with bulevirtide. And it will be interesting to see when they actually have head-to-head trials of both of these programs against bulevirtide, how they'll do. But I think we anticipate, and similarly, I think the companies anticipate that they will show that they are doing probably, you know, more effective in virologic response compared to bulevirtide in the same time period.
Yeah, I also think that I believe both companies, but are looking at individuals who are bulevirtide exposed, then switching over to one of these other alternatives, just because so many places have had bulevirtide longer than the U.S., which it's brand new. And so the populations there, there are a lot of Delta bulevirtide exposed patients that are not fully virologically suppressed.
Right. And I think, you know, I mentioned about the efficacy, which we're excited about. I think the other obviously next question that comes is the safety and what are we seeing with these new mechanisms of drugs. And overall, I think both of the programs have reassuring safety data. Most of what we're seeing is injection site reactions, which is not surprising. There's also a little bit of a signal for kind of these flu-like symptoms that are seen in both, maybe a little bit more in one company than the other. And, you know, and those flu-like symptoms probably come from your immune response to this monoclonal antibody. So I think, you know, aside from those, it seems like both appear well tolerated. Although if we had another hour, we could talk about the ALT question and, you know, why the ALT and the HDV RNA don't always go in parallel in terms of their decline. And could there be aspects that lead to, you know, even ALT flares in some of these treatments? But I think we can save the ALT flare discussion for another time when we talk about B also, because I think that comes up there as well.
That actually gets just a quick question about bulevirtide in terms of sort of risk, right?
Yes.
In a patient who may stop medication. It is a daily injection. So having patients take drug holidays or just deciding they don't want to do it for a while, you know, do we have good data around the risk to those individuals?
Yeah, it's a question that also has been coming up in these discussions. I mean, one thing I'll say is that it seems that, you know, especially from real world data that now we have from Europe and studies as well, that the longer that the patient is undetected while on treatment, the better the prognosis that they will have off treatment. And specifically, you know, if they were undetected for 96 weeks on bulevirtide treatment, then they're more likely to have sustained off treatment response. And then in terms of, you know, like immediate flare after treatment withdrawal, I don't know, Nancy, have you heard much about it?
No, I mean, there's definitely agents where you see flares, and in some of the clinical trials, although I don't know that was reported exactly, but I know I had patients that seemed to be flaring when their treatment was stopped, but I've not, you know, my personal experience with bulevirtide is quite limited through the compassionate use program. And my patients are still on agents, so I haven't seen them stop, but I've not heard of significant flares.
Yeah. I think the counseling would be, you know, because a question that will come up is, well, will I really be on this forever once you start it? And I think the counseling is generally you will be on it long term, but if you have sustained undetectability for a prolonged time, you can consider stopping with close monitoring.
I know that Tatiana, you have some morning activities, so I don't want to make you late, but I think that this is really exciting. When we talk about B in the future, so listeners, please stay tuned. We're going to get Tatiana back to talk about hepatitis B. Maybe we can also talk about B and D in the context of transplant, because I think that also was changing some of the conversation. But as a reminder, this is the Liver Lineup, Updates and Unfiltered Insights with Kim Brown and Nancy Rowe, and our special guest with Tatiana Kushner. And we're really excited. This has been a great way to start my morning.
Thank you so much
Thanks,
for the
Tatiana.
invitation.